This podcast is brought to you by Minimal Productions, producer Jim Mintz.
This is Diplomates, a geopolitical chinwag with your host, Misha Zielinski.
G'day and welcome to Diplomates. I'm your host, Misha Zielinski. This week I caught up with Eric Schultz. Eric is the founder of the Schultz Group and is currently a senior advisor to former President Barack Obama. He served in the White House as the principal deputy press secretary and special assistant to the president. Recognized by Politico as the strategist White House officials turned to in a crisis, Schultz advised the president, spoke on behalf of the administration on Air Force One and in the White House briefing room, and helped manage the administration's general messaging. Schultz is a veteran of numerous statewide and national campaigns and is a bit of a legend around DC circles, where he is known amongst Washington reporters for his aggressive behind-the-scenes approach. I caught up with Eric for a chinwag about life in the Obama White House, how to manage a crisis, the three secret words of communications, what the Situation Room is actually like, election 2020 predictions, why politicians must be authentic today, whether hope beats fear, and what President Obama is really like off camera. It's a really fun chat, and I really hope you enjoy it. Eric is super generous with his time, and it was a lot of fun making the episode. If you are enjoying the show, please jump on Twitter and Instagram. Give me a follow, Misha Zielinski or Diplomate Show are the handles. Let me know what you think of the episode. Plenty of you are already on there heckling me, and I'm happy to dive deeper into things we chat about in this episode and others. As ever, 5-star reviews are appreciated. They help game the algorithm, and they do push me up above Putin and others. Without further delay, please enjoy the episode. Eric Schultz, welcome to Diplomates. Thanks for joining us, mate.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Now, as ever, there's so many places to start with someone who's had such a big career like yourself. But given we're heading into election season, I thought I might take you back in time just quickly, back to 2016, the night of the last presidential election. How surprised, I suppose, were you at this result? And what were your feelings on the night?
You know, when I agreed to do this conversation, I wasn't sure we had to sort of relive that night, but I'm happy to to indulge. The question is, was I surprised? And yes, absolutely. I don't think like sort of stunned, flabbergasted, bowled over sort of do it justice. I think that all of us, sort of in the country, but also in the White House, were anticipating that Secretary Clinton was going to prevail on election night. So to say we were stunned is a bit of an understatement. But I will say that President Obama, gathered all of us the next morning, Wednesday morning, as many of us sort of trenched into work, having stayed up the entire night and were just sort of exhausted and emotionally drained and just sort of empty inside and sort of a whole whirlwind of emotions and thoughts going through our head. He was the one who sort of called us into the Oval Office early that Wednesday morning and said, look, the sort of storyline of history is that it zigs and it zags and it doesn't always go in a straight direction. And that as sort of public servants and as sort of the keepers of democracy at that moment, our job was to follow through with a peaceful transition of power. He wanted to send a signal that morning that, the sun is going to rise and that, the sort of foundations of our country and the values and sort of the democratic small d institutions that we have are strong enough to withstand any particular, any singular election result. And so it was under his direction that we sent that message loudly and clearly on Wednesday morning and then spent the next two or three months providing for a real peaceful transition of power. And that meant, at the principal level in terms of President Obama and President-elect Trump convening, but down to the staff level, making sure that his team knew as much as possible going into this, that, sort of when you land a new job in a new building in a new weird place, that they sort of had as much sort of knowledge and support on the front end of that as possible. And I certainly communicated with my sort of counterpart who was going to sort of replace me. And I said, look, we met once, I can't remember if that was December or January, but, or November, but I said, look, you know, I'm happy to be available to you. We can meet in private, we can meet in public, we can meet, you know, email, talk, whatever you want to do. And that was based on the directive from the president to be as helpful as possible to the incoming team.
And so, look, we'll talk probably a little bit about the Trump White House. I'd like to talk about, you know, your time in the Obama White House. Now, you were in a position, you know, advising him on communications. I mean, firstly, I suppose, I mean, it's a high position of high levels of trust. I mean, how did you earn President Obama's trust in that? And then how were you able to, I suppose, advise him around his expectations of his comms team?
Yeah, so I started in the White House in the spring of 2011, which is when Republicans had taken over the House of Representatives, one chamber of the U.S. Congress, and they vowed all of this congressional oversight into the administration, a whole bunch of investigations. And the White House smartly decided to hire a bunch of outside people to help manage the response to those investigations. So they hired a bunch, mostly lawyers, but some researchers and communications people. And so for my early years in the White House, that was sort of the scope of my portfolio, was managing the response to those investigations. My sort of purview sort of broadened from there. And then when Jay Carney left and Josh Earnest became the press secretary in 2014, he asked me to be his deputy. And I tell people it's a little bit like being, I guess, you know, I usually say Miss America runner up, right? That when Josh couldn't perform his duties, they sort of roll me out and I'd try and do the best job that I could. And it was really from that perch where I developed a relationship with President Obama. And the truth of the matter is, a lot of that relationship was sort of nourished playing cards with the president, just on long trips. What he does to sort of clear his mind is to just sort of relax, is to play cards. And so we on a lot of plane rides.
What was the game?
Spades. And I was terrible, and he is super competitive, but he's also very sort of mentoring. And so, as a cruel joke, I was on his team, which is the worst case scenario because he's dependent on you.
Right.
And so not only is he competitive, he's thankfully very forgiving. And so that's where we sort of developed a personal relationship. And then obviously in the middle of these trips, there's a lot of sort of communications and messaging, sort of judgment calls and sort of conversations we would have in order for him to sort of, you know, again, learn to trust me. I did not work on the president's 2008 campaign. So I was not sort of part of that team that sort of worked with him to get to the White House. So I consider myself very lucky that even as an outsider, I was able to sort of develop a relationship with him.
And so, I mean, what are some of your best and worst moments in the White House then, given that, I mean, you've sort of clearly had a good relationship with the president. I imagine it wasn't always all sunshine and rainbows. It's a tough environment. It's high pressure, high stakes environment.
Yeah, the worst, I don't know if this made international headlines, but the president's signature sort of domestic legislative accomplishment in the first term was universal health care and what we called the Affordable Care Act, which later became known as Obamacare. Yep. And this is something that, again, presidents, I think dating back to Teddy Roosevelt, had tried to do and tried to get done. And President Obama got this done in 2009 in his first year in office. And it was a very complicated piece of business, but it required sort of transforming, I think, 1/6 of the U.S. economy is healthcare based. And so it was going to be moving a lot of different pieces. And we had until 2014 to prepare to implement it. And over the course of those years, that meant sort of putting pen to paper and getting all of the sort of infrastructure in place. And we, again, given it was the president's signature domestic accomplishment, we wanted to make sure nothing could go wrong. And but it was going to require a whole bunch of buy-in and support from everyone under the sun, the hospitals, the drug makers, patients, healthcare providers, insurers, politicians, civic leaders, businesses, sort of everyone under the sun sort of had to be sort of bought into this in order to make it work. And we put in a lot of, you know, years of work to get ready for the launch. And again, I don't know if this was an international affair, but we did launch and everything that we had put into it didn't work because the website flopped.
And I'd like to tell you that we didn't hear about that, mate. But unfortunately, as you were telling that story, I was saying, I hope this isn't about the website.
Yeah, this is about the website. You asked for my worst time in the White House, and it was 100% the healthcare.gov flailing.
Yeah, that couldn't have been a fun time. But sorry, keep going.
It was terrible. And to the president's credit, he understood that, you know, this wasn't a communications problem. This was just a problem. And he understood that until the website got fixed, you know, the sort of breathless, nonstop, around-the-clock coverage of this failure wasn't going to change. And so again, we sort of like stood up a task force and sort of surged our Department of Health and Human Services with resources and Silicon Valley experts and a whole bunch of assets to sort of redo that website and get it up and running as soon as humanly possible. And, you know, as a communicator, it's a story about, I don't want to say damage control because there wasn't really a way to control that damage. But in terms of being open and transparent with reporters and the country about what we were doing to fix the problem. And I think we had something like a weekly or maybe even more frequent than that conference call where we would talk through at a very technical level what specifications we were fixing that day, what our estimates were for people being able to get through and sign up. And eventually, we got a website that worked and a program that, you know, ensured 20 million new Americans.
And was that in terms of, you know, you're someone that goes and stands at the lectern or did, you know, in terms of the preparation that goes into something like that, I mean, how difficult is it to get totally across all the information you got to have be briefed on, but then you are briefing the media on? I mean, it's an extraordinarily challenging task for one person to do. I mean, maybe give us a sense.
Yeah. Right. So this is one of those that I can only speak to my experience in the Obama White House. And, you know, others may judge it as a contrast with our current White House. My understanding is that our sort of processes track closely our predecessors. So the Bush administration, the Clinton administration. And essentially, when the press secretary speaks from the podium, we're not just shooting from the hip. The reason we go out with a sort of a thick binder of talking points and guidance is because we understand that we are speaking for not just the president, but for the United States of America on a world stage. And I think that in politics, a lot of us get ridiculed for being so careful in our language. There's political speak and there's, we can get sort of mocked for being very, very generic or very vague. But the reason we do that is important. When you're speaking for the White House, your words carry enormous weight and you can move stock markets, you can alienate allies, you can mobilize armies, you can annoy your friends, and so what we tried to do is make sure that when, you know, Josh or myself or Robert Gibbs or Jay Carney, whoever was speaking for the administration on any given day, was sort of fully prepared with guidance that represented the entire the sort of 360 degree viewpoint of the U.S. government. And so sometimes that's complicated. Sometimes, if we're talking about the Iran nuclear negotiations, right, that is a process that involves, you know, the State Department, since Secretary Kerry was the lead negotiator, that involves Department of Energy, Department of Interior, that involves our Office of Legislative Affairs to make sure Congress is looped, our Office of Public Engagement to make sure sort of the climate and energy activists are comfortable with what we're saying. That includes our White House Counsel's Office to make sure that legally we're sort of in the right lanes. So when we speak, again, it wasn't just what sort of the press people want to say. It's language that we know has to be carefully vetted throughout sort of all the different components of the administration.
That's an extraordinarily difficult challenge. You can understand why it does sometimes sound a little, for lack of a better word, nuance or more like a UN resolution.
Yeah.
But I mean, so, you know, the current president is very, well, he watches press conferences very closely of his press secretaries. Was there ever a moment where you got off and thought, well, that's it, I'm fired? You know, this went that badly, I've tanked. I really hope I don't see the president in the next 24 hours.
Thank God, thank goodness, no. I will say, and that's not to say I didn't make mistakes, I made plenty. But, you know, the three hardest words I had to learn when briefing the press were, I don't know. And that is not an instinct that comes naturally. You sort of want to flub your way through and sort of find some sort of space to talk, to give an answer. But I think at the end of the day, reporters will respect you more if you're willing to acknowledge that you don't have the answer at your fingertips, and you'll follow up with them and get them the best answer you can.
Yeah, I think that's a really good lesson. In terms of, you know, you've talked a lot about all the things going on. I mean, what's one of the biggest crises that you dealt with at the White House? And I mean, and how do you go about, you know, communicating that? And what was, you know, I suppose as a comms specialist, what are the key principles of crisis communications? Because, you know, a lot of people in politics listen to this show. Big audience in political circles. I mean, I think I heard everyone lean in a little as I said that. Kind of curious for your take.
Yeah. I was thinking about this question, and I was thinking back to the G20 summit in 2016 in Hangzhou, China. And this was sort of, obviously, it's sort of at the end of the presidency, and it was a moment where we were trying to sort of wrap up and sort of make some finishing, some sort of like end game progress on a lot of the president's priorities. And, you know, I think we had negotiated a pretty strong deal with President Xi on on greenhouse gas emissions. We had made some progress on cyber, on a whole host of other issues. You know, at the time, sort of dealing with Syria and dealing with refugees were both sort of like very hot ticket items. And we had sort of, President Obama had worked closely with a bunch of other foreign leaders to make progress on those issues. But the thing that dominated the coverage of that G20 was that the Chinese officials at the airport used the wrong stairs for Marine One when the President Obama descended the aircraft. And this is something that sort of dominated 3 or 4 days worth of coverage back here in the United States.
Big issues.
Yeah, exactly. That it was read as this sort of big Chinese snub of the American president. And a sort of voracious sort of appetite to cover the optics of the stairs versus the actual substance of what we were trying to accomplish on the ground as part of the summit. And, you know, as much as we could sort of cajole reporters into focusing on sort of issues that actually mattered and not the sort of circumstances that surrounded which staircase the president used to descend the aircraft upon arriving in China, you know, we had mixed success. And, you know, eventually they, at one of the press briefings, they asked President Obama about it. And he said, look, I wouldn't overcrank this, that, you know, that there's a lot of sort of, the truth is, and I sort of remember this, there was a mix-up at the airport. It was a smaller airport and it just didn't have the right driver of the right stairs. So it was a very sort of technical staffing, bureaucratic sort of snafu. But again, it got sort of ballooned into this sort of like international affair of outsized proportion. And again, we just tried our best to focus reporters on substance and what work was actually unfolding on the ground as opposed to, you know, that sort of stuff.
It must be frustrating though, right? Trying to get people to focus on the substance rather than the triviality. I mean, that's a bigger problem that no single press secretary is going to solve on their own. In terms of, you know, broadening out a little bit more to sort of general in politics and good communications, I mean, you know, what do you think the biggest mistakes you observe people trying to communicate in noisy environments, and how do you reckon, what's the best way to cut through in that sense?
Yeah, I think that's a profound question. It's sort of the biggest challenge we face. And I think that in the White House, we had a saying that, you know, our strategy was to find audiences where they are at. And that was sort of our guiding principle. So I'll give you a few examples. You know, when the president was negotiating, when the United States was negotiating the Paris Climate Accord in 2015, we wanted a way to sort of sell this to the American public in a way that sort of was outside the sort of typical political conversation. And the president went to visit the Arctic. He was the first sitting president to visit the Arctic. And we didn't, at the time, when assessing our media, developing a media strategy, you know, we decided we weren't going to sit down with 60 Minutes or the Washington Post or the New York Times. We sat down with Bear Grylls, who I don't know if you all know, but he's an outdoorsman. He's got a couple of shows.
Kind of like Steve Irwin was, right?
Yeah, exactly. An outdoorsman who just sort of thrives in natural environments. And we wanted to be able to break through to an audience that, again, doesn't follow the day-to-day of the Paris negotiations or what's happening in the, House Subcommittee on Interior, but rather just appreciates clean air, clean water, wants their kids to grow up in a world that is healthy. And so we did an hour-long primetime special with Bear Grylls, where President Obama and him sort of, it was a beautiful set where they sort of, wandered outside and I think they sort of caught raw fish with their bare hands and all that stuff. And it was a really nice setting in order to, again, to sort of break through what we were doing, why we were doing it, but to an audience that wasn't necessarily attuned to the politics.
But it's hard. It's increasingly hard to find new audiences, right? People are very much in their bubbles, or it is hard to cut through to people that aren't just probably like you or I, or listens to this podcast, addicts to the political news cycle. So it is challenging. It's an interesting way that you guys did it. Now, just switching up to 2020, or at least to present day, one of the things I'd like to be curious about before we talk about the election and President Trump more generally, you clearly, you're still advising President Obama. He intervenes very rarely, I suppose, into politics, like most former presidents. I mean, how do you make an assessment when that should be, on which topic, in which way? Because it is, I mean, you know, former presidents' words carry a particular weight, particularly the predecessor, and I think particularly, when you consider the relationship between the current president and the former president.
Yep. It's a great question. I think much like many chapters of President Obama's public life, this is the first post-presidency of its kind. I don't think any other former U.S. president has had to sort of face what President Obama has. And look, the truth is President Obama believes deeply in sort of this American principle of one president at a time. He believes that for a couple of reasons. One is, he is mindful and respectful and grateful for the latitude that his predecessor gave to him while he was serving in office. And again, that was after a 2008 presidential campaign where President Obama was quite aggressive towards President Bush and his policies. But mostly it is because President Obama believes that in order for the Democratic Party here in the U.S. to move on, that the next generation of leaders need to step up. And that if he gets outsized attention for when he speaks out, and if he is always sort of soaking up the limelight and soaking up the oxygen, that really limits the ability for the next wave of leaders to sort of step up and take hold. And he's been very careful to make sure that he will speak out when he feels American values are threatened, and we have on a whole host of issues. But in the whole, he wants to make sure that sort of the next wave of Democratic leaders is able to sort of command the spotlight and grow into their roles as national leaders.
Yeah, it must be very difficult at times to bite his tongue, given it seems he's got an administration that wants to bait him at every opportunity, if not at the podium via Twitter or other channels. And then also you've got a very noisy media environment in the conservative media space. Now, kind of on a personal level, that someone's been behind the press podium, you know, what sort of goes through your head when you've watched the press briefings, I suppose, throughout the duration of the Trump administration thus far? I mean, do you ever feel a little bit sorry for the person at the time? Like they sort of go up there, take a beating? You're shaking your head for those watching at home.
No, I mean, look, it's because I still work for President Obama, I'm sort of constrained in how much I can talk about the current administration. I will say, though, that for me, I do get this a lot, which is, how can you stand to watch the press briefing? It's like, how can you stand to watch the press briefing? You know, it's pretty cringeworthy for anyone. And so, you know, I will just say as a top line that, look, credibility matters. And it doesn't just matter. I think it's everything. And I think that, you know, don't get me wrong. There's plenty of combative conversations and exchanges I had with reporters. And, you know, we always sort of put our best spin on the ball and aggressively made our sort of strongest argument and wanted to make sure that that was sort of presented to the press. But I think reporters would back us up. We never knowingly lied. We never knowingly misled anyone. You know, if we did, it was an error. It was sort of an errant one-off mistake that we sort of owned up to. And so I just think as a communicator, again, whether you're representing, you know, President of the United States, a foreign leader, a state senator, you member of Congress, a business leader, you know, whoever, that you have to be straight with people. That, I mean, it's probably a good personal rule of thumb, even if you're not a communicator. But that once you sort of undermine your own credibility, it is virtually impossible to regain it. And, you know, we're sort of going through a few news cycles here where the White House is having to contend with, other sort of anonymous sources and other reports and other things where if they had credibility over the past 4 years, they'd have more standing to make effective arguments and to be more persuasive. But because there's sort of a pattern of not telling the truth, they are, you know, in a weaker position to make their case. And so, that's my biggest takeaway. And again, it doesn't just pertain to the White House. I think whenever you're sort of speaking for someone or a company or a group or a candidate or public official, whatever, that if the person on the other side of the conversation doesn't believe that you are telling the truth, then you're not doing your job.
Now it's a really well-made point. I think that's exactly right. I mean, you can say whatever you want, but if there's zero credibility behind it, makes it very difficult to spin. Though it is hard to spin, I imagine, 18 separate recordings of interviews with Bob Woodward. There's only so much one can spin on that. Were you shocked that the president had given 18 on the record interviews to the person that took down Nixon?
There's a funny rule of thumb in Washington. The only thing worse than not engaging Bob Woodward when working on a book is engaging Bob Woodward when he's working on a book.
Well, I guess President Trump's about to find that out because there was fear where they didn't engage and now there's rage where they have engaged 18 times. So.
Look, I don't want to comment on their strategy. I think that, we had plenty of critical books written about President Obama and sometimes they are hard to navigate, right? Reporters are not, you know, they're not novices. They know how to sort of like start from the outside, people who might be less informed and work their way up. And so we had to navigate plenty of books. Plenty of them were not particularly complimentary about President Obama. I I think Woodward, you know, is obviously one of the legendary journalists of our time. But given how, given the track record of this White House and sort of contravening their own comments, that he was very shrewd to get tapes.
Indeed. Now, switching up to, you know, we are, you know, I'm not sure how many days out, not a great number of days out, probably 50 days out from the election. You know, what's your take on this year's elections? What can we expect? It's going to probably be a wild ride. I mean, clearly most of us in the game, and I've said this on this podcast before, I was horrendously wrong on 2016 and the outcome. You know, what's your take on it thus far on the matchup between former Vice President Biden and President Trump?
Yeah, I mean, your caveat's well taken. I think we were all tremendously wrong about 2016, so take that for what it's worth, audience. But look, I think, you know, President Trump has tremendous advantages on his side, but he's got a lot of crosswinds too. Our country's suffering from a global health pandemic that in many other sort of corners of the world has been much better managed. Other sort of racial injustice challenges that he is not sort of calmed, but rather has stoked. And an economy that is in a really challenging spot. And so it's up to Vice President Biden to sort of make the case that he can get us to a better path. I think that a lot of the data suggests that people are sort of clamoring for sort of precisely Vice President Biden's message of sort of unifying the country and bringing us together and restoring just sort of basic competency back to the administration. I think you're right. I think it's going to be a dogfight for the next 50 days. Both of our conventions, the Republican and Democratic conventions, are now over. And so Vice President Biden has sort of selected his running mate. And so the next sort of three big sort of moments for our sort of domestic political calendar are the three debates. President Trump and Vice President Biden will face off in three debates. The first one is sort of at the end of September. And then the two others are in October. And so those will be sort of big moments that get a lot of attention. But other than that, I think there's just a lot of sort of back and forth between the two camps. But I think that, you know, clearly in our primary process and now in our general election, there is a yearning for sort of a return to sort of steady, strong, capable leadership. The type of vision that I think people associate with Vice President Biden. You know, Vice President Biden's been around for a long time. He's obviously was President Obama's vice president for 8 years, but before that served in the Senate for a while. And he's a known commodity. People sort of know his story. They respect him. They know that he's a good, decent sort of public servant in it for the right reasons. Like a lot of voters in Australia, people aren't necessarily digging into the sort of white papers and all the policy sheets, but they're going to vote based on their values. And if they feel that, Vice President Biden animates them and is consistent with sort of the character and principle of what they want to see in the White House, then I think he's going to win.
Now, I mean, you're a messaging guy. You work for one of the most legendary presidents who ran on a positive message, a hope message, and you've got a president now who very much prosecutes, I suppose, the antithesis of that. You know, it's a fear message. In this election, you know, does hope beat fear or does fear beat hope? I mean, because both candidates are painting very different, I suppose. You know, you look at the way the conventions went, they're painting very different. Your point about competency, I think, is well made. I think people are certainly yearning for that. But, I mean, how do you see that messaging battle playing out? And which one typically wins in your assessment? Because
yeah, it's a great question. And since I still work for President Obama, I'm going to be an optimist.
I would expect otherwise, but yeah.
No, look, I think there is a clamor. Our country is sort of going through a very painful time, and there is protest, there's unrest, there's unimaginable death and pain and sickness and illness. And there's job loss, there's rising poverty. And I think that people really are hungry for a better path. And I think that Vice President Biden has been very precise in how he's presented his alternative to the current scenario. And that if people want to go back to a basic approach where government is on your side and just trying to make things better, we don't have all the solutions and we're not going to be able to sort of snap our fingers to get out of this, but that we, you know, return to a government that respects the rule of law, respects the freedom of the press, respects scientists, respects sort of democratic institutions, then I think that is why the vice president sort of gained traction in the primary. And that's why I think he's doing well right now. I don't think that people want sort of more of the same chaos and division and fear that President Trump stokes. And that's why I'm, you know, optimistic.
And so, you know, you mentioned you're still working for President Obama. So noting that you're still on the payroll, we might have to discount this answer slightly. But, I mean, I thought maybe you might just give us a sense, you know, a lot of us, we watch people on TV and you make an assessment of what sort of person they are. I think the current president, you get a pretty good sense of what sort of person he is. I always thought as well with President Obama that he would be very similar to the way he presented in public, in, you know, long form interviews, et cetera. It seemed like frankly, a pretty cool guy. Can you maybe give us I'm sure he's listening to this, and so obviously you'll need to catch your remarks, mate. But kind of maybe if you could just give us a little bit of insight there, if you mind.
Yeah, I mean, the bummer is you're right. I am still on the payroll, so I get paid to say this, but it is the truth, which is the guy you have seen on the world stage for the past, you know, 10 or 12 years has been is the guy that I talk to in person. He's as worldly and as smart as you'd think, but just as down to earth as you'd hope. And and I don't think that's an accident. In other words, I think that we now live in a media environment that you have a real intimacy with your public officials, right? This isn't a time where politics is sort of happening distantly and you watch the news at 6:30 at night and get a report, right? You are constantly sort of in their space, they are in your space. And the reason that President Obama, I think, was so successful and effective is because there was an authenticity to him. And that voters have a really good sort of whiff that if you're being fake, that's a red flag. And, yeah. And I think that has become, that is a sort of a newer phenomenon that you could sort of get away with a facade or personal, a public persona that's different than who you are personally. But I don't think that works anymore. And so I think that's largely one of the reasons why he's been so successful is he is who he is.
Yeah, I think that's really a good point. It's very difficult to survive the glare of so many cameras and social media and the consistent cut through. Now, in terms of, you talked about things being as they are. One thing you're a consultant on the hit TV show Designated Survivor.
Yes.
In one of your comments, you talked about the fact that Hollywood's portrayal of the White House is not like what it's like to work there in terms of its salubriousness or otherwise. Maybe you could just quickly give us a rundown of that, mate.
Yeah, I worked on the show Designated Survivor for the third season. Netflix here rebooted it, and it was a blast to work on. And it was an experience for me because you had a bunch of writers out in Los Angeles who had never, I mean, I'm sure some of them had been to Washington, but none of them had worked in government, and most of them had not been inside the White House. So they are writing 60 minutes worth of content about a setting and environment they had never been in. And so it was a great moment. It was a great opportunity for me to sort of walk them through what's realistic inside the White House. And again, not all of my suggestions were taken, but it was a fun moment to connect what they wanted, their sort of Hollywood storylines, to sort of still have some realism. And the sort of pictures of the Situation Room that people sort of hear a lot about are much more glamorous than what they actually are, which is sort of a couple of cavernous conference rooms with some digital wall clocks and TV screens that have telecommunications capabilities.
Careful, mate. Putin might be listening. You don't want to give the
guy away. I know. And we have, one of the storylines that the writers did like was we had problems with mice pretty frequently. And in order to address the problem with mice, it wasn't just like one phone call. It was sort of a bureaucratic process of our General Services Administration and sort of like who can call who and get what apparatus over the building to sort of address the very acute problems that there's rodents at my feet. As writers, they had fun with that. I think that sort of how Hollywood portrays Washington, it's obviously fun entertainment, but I do think this is how a lot of people get their information. And I think a lot of people's sort of understanding of government, the White House, how Washington works is often derived from popular culture.
Well, there's one final question before you go. Now, typically, because this is a heavy foreign policy show, it's very difficult for me to get in anything approaching a non-clumsy segue, but we are talking about mice and rodents in the White House. So it's a little bit easier to switch up to barbecues at Eric's place. Now, you are an American guest, so you have to have three Australians. We've already mentioned Steve Irwin, so he's out. But three Aussies to barbecue at Eric's, and why?
I know. So I was planning on doing a lot of homework to like research this question of authors, civic leaders, or, sort of Aussies who have been impressive on the world stage. I did none of that homework.
Very good.
I even wanted, one of my dreams is to come to the Australian Open. So I was looking at sort of Australian tennis players. I was really trying to sort of roll up my sleeves and get you good guidance. But I think I'm just going to fall back on sort of the answers I'm sure all of your American guests give you of, Nicole Kidman, Russell Crowe, and Hugh Jackman.
Three?
What's that?
They're three?
They're going to be my three. I don't know if the show...
I don't know if they're friends. We should probably check that. But I mean, I guess they are. I don't know. There might be some...
It would be very convenient. Yeah, exactly. I want to make this easy for them.
Yeah, they all can come in the same car. I don't know if Russell Crowe and Hugh Jackman get along. I don't know. Maybe there's a rivalry between them.
Well, they were both in Les Miserables together, the sort of film of that. So I'm happy to sort of web, sort of like diagram the connections.
Now, I'll give you these, even though Russell Crowe, strictly speaking, is a New Zealander.
Oh, shoot.
No, that's fine, mate. Look,
I've never met him, but from what I know from his reputation, I'm not surprised you want to distance yourself from
him. As I always say, look, we have a very popular trope in Australia where all New Zealanders who are successful on the world stage become Australians. So, he was gratefully adopted, though, when he gets into trouble, he became New Zealander, Russell Crowe. But he's a very popular guy in Australia, owns a football team. Seems like a good bloke to have a beer with. So you'd be a good guy to have any barbecue. Anyway, look, Eric, thanks so much for coming on the show. It's been a fantastic chat, and I really appreciate your time, mate.
Of course. Great to be here.
G'day, Diplomates fans. One last thing before you go. If some of you have questions or particular guests you'd like me to get on, please let me know via Twitter or Instagram. You can find me on there at Misha Zielinski or at Diplomate Show. The handles are available in the show notes. Shoot through any questions you'd like me to ask guests. I will read them onto the future shows that I do record. Furthermore, if you've got things you'd like to discuss with me about anything that was said in this episode or other episodes, get on there, let me know. I do read all the comments. I do also enjoy them all, including the heckling. So thanks again for all your support. I hope you enjoyed the episode. See you next time.
You were just listening to Diplomates, a geopolitical chinwag. For more episodes, visit www.diplomates.show or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or through any of your favorite podcast channels.
This podcast was brought to you by Minimal Productions, producer Jim Mintz.